are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, January 14th, 2016. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Marissa Baradaran, professor of law at Georgia Law School, on how the other half banks, exclusion, exploitation, and threat to democracy. Speaking of threat to democracy, Republican debate happening tonight. We will be covering it live at majority.fm. We will have a video stream of the debate with our added value, making it clearly fair use. However, I will tell you that we anticipate Fox Business to shut down our YouTube feed, at least for the live version. We will have audio. They can't touch that. Can't touch this, I think, as we used to say back in the day.
You actually ever say that?
No.
Okay.
Never
All right.
Did.
I was a little unsettled by that.
I would reference, I can't even remember the name of that guy's, who was it?
MC Hammer, man.
MC Hammer, of course.
That's before my time.
I did wear the outfit. I did wear the same outfit. It was sort of a like a vinyl jumpsuit, I think it was.
I think we'll be all in the chains with
you. So you can't touch that. So what we would suggest is you listen to the broadcast from us. Turn down your TV. It should sync up. Meanwhile, more horror in Flint. Legionnaire's disease breaks out. In Florida, they dropped the standard of care for babies with heart disease and heart surgeries after some hospitals donate money to the Republican Party. I mean, just some of this stuff. Meanwhile, good news. Gitmo prisoners dropped below 100 for the first time since 2002. And in the heating up primaries, huge oppo dump, it seems, on the Republican side. Cruz, an unaccounted for $500,000 loan from Goldman Sachs. He's a man of the people. Everybody gets loans for $500,000 from Goldman Sachs. You got the real story, I think, that's going to hurt him on the campaign is what was he putting up for collateral? It was his Goldman Sachs account. Rubio apparently involved in some conflict of interest on the immigration side. This is all going to come out tonight in the debate. It is going to be a vicious, vicious debate. I gotta imagine that Jeb Bush is excited as hell to be on the end. Like, he's now been pushed out. You know what would be really cool is to take images of the Republican debates, like still images, and do like one of those time lapse of Jeb just moving from the center and getting further and further out as he makes it to the edge.
And then the next
one is he falls off the stage.
That was ethical lapse, Marco. And I'm not going to, you know, I vote in Florida. So I'm mad about that as well. And Donald, if you would please just stop talking for about 10 minutes, I'm going to zing you. Okay, queued up. Zing ready.
The best is that Jeb is actually saying that in the green room before the debate.
I feel pumped. I just had a Cliff Bar, and you know, I mean, I'm ready to go. I mean, you know, there's ISIS, and there's more money that my family wants from tax breaks, and you know, and then there's my brother and my whole sort of core identity collapsing around me. So you know, high game stakes and stuff tonight.
You know that George P., his son, who George H.W. famously referred to as one of the little brown ones, is calling up his dad and just saying, thanks for nothing, Dad.
I let down one of the little brown ones myself.
Because Jeb was strutting around like, I'm going to take my son around. He's going to meet the donors. He's going to feel what it feels like to be the son of, at the very least, the Republican nominee. And I'm going to basically cleanse the palate of the American public's palate of that sort of bitter taste that they had after George W. and the tiny little war thing and the whole like financial crisis. All that's gonna mission accomplished all over again. And thanks, Dad. Good job. If we're lucky, my kid will be able to maybe run for county commissioner.
I'm not like my brother at all. I'm boring, and I have no basic kind of emotional touch. And he might even be more intellectually rigorous than I am.
You could just take the posters like George W. Bush. You'd love to have a beer with him, and with Jeb Bush, it's like you'd love to have a glass of hemlock or something.
Xanax is pretty good. It's helping me out.
He's the guy. Do the old arsenic test. Would you like to sit at a bar and then after like an hour with this guy, it's just like you'll do anything. You'll commit suicide just right there. I'm exhausted, folks. We Michael and I got up early this morning to do Ari Rabinhoff's show. I think it's called The Agenda on
The Agenda.
Sirius Satellite Radio. I mean, I imagine anybody who listens to this program about Sirius Satellite already, you know, listens to that stuff. I don't know how many people listen to Sirius, but I'm exhausted because I got no sleep last night because my kids woke me up. However, most people spend about a third of your life sleeping. For me, like I say, it's about, I don't know, 1/16th at this point because I've got kids. Today's sponsor is Casper Mattresses. They are obsessively engineered American-made mattresses at a shockingly fair price. Now you can get $50 towards any mattress purchase by going to casper.com/majority using the code majority. Casper brings together two comfy technologies for better nights and brighter days. Latex foam and memory foam. So they got the right sink, they got the right bounce, no matter how you sleep. They have, and this is what's amazing about Casper, in my mind. I mean, the prices are incredibly reasonable. But they've got a risk-free trial and return policy. They deliver it straight to you. You can try the mattress for 100 days, and if you're not happy, they'll pick it back up. At a store, you get like, what, 15, 5 minutes? I mean, if you lie down on a mattress at a store, at like a mattress store, and you're there for more than 3 minutes, they start giving you like cross-eyed looks.
Basically.
It's like, dude, I'm going to be sleeping on this for the rest of, you know, I don't know, for the next 5-10 years.
Jump on it for five and give us money. Get out.
With Casper, you actually get to sleep on it for 100 days. Like, Michael, with the amount of times that you move, you could literally just keep getting a new mattress every time you move. You move like every 3 months.
You nailed it. Every 3 months.
It's $500 for a twin size mattress, $950 for a king size mattress. Comparing that to industry averages, that's an outstanding price. So get $50 toward any mattress purchase by going to Casper.com /majority using the code majority. As always, ladies and gentlemen, terms and conditions apply.
Moving again, both.
Also, before we get to Marissa Baradaran, Michael tonight, before apparently he does the debate, I guess tonight,
yes,
is going to be doing WTP Live.
We the People Live.
We the People Live at 7:30 at the Pinhide Map? The Pine Box Rock Shop.
Pine Box Rock Shop.
Yeah, I did it there once.
And with Josh Zepps, and I'll be on a panel with Artie Lang and some other great people starting at 7:30.
Okay, there you have it.
If you're around, you want to show up.
If you want to go and drink beer and watch Michael. And then Michael hopefully will come over here and do his job. But whatever. All right,
just
folks,
give me some time leeway.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Marissa Baradaran. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Marissa Baradaran. She is the professor of law at Georgia Law School and author of How the Other Half Banks, Exclusion, Exploitation, and Threat to Democracy. Marissa, thank you so much for joining us. And again, apologies if I'm mispronouncing your last name. I'm famously incapable of pronouncing anything.
I am. I have a very unique name, and so I'm not at all offended. And thank you so much for having me here.
I get even non-unique names wrong. I should say, just in
I do too. Actually, I cannot pronounce names. There's a great Key and Peele skit, and I feel like I'm always that substitute teacher.
Oh, good. That's good. See that sketch. All right. Well, all right, great. Let's talk about this. I got to tell you right up front that. I am a huge, and I don't want to get ahead of ourselves, but I am a massive fan of the concept of postal banking. We have done a couple of different interviews on it on this program, but there's one aspect of the way that you talk about postal banking and credit, which I had really never explored much. So I'm very interested in getting there. But before we get to sort of the solution, let's talk about the problem. Give us just a slight history of banking in this country, because I, for one, did not realize that payday lenders, and explain that to folks who are not quite clear on what those are, but I didn't realize that they hadn't been around for that long. I mean, they've only been around since the 80s in great amount, and I wasn't aware of that. Give us a slight history lesson on banking, if you would.
Sure, absolutely. And I think the problem here is a lot of people focus on payday lending you know, as it is. And so we try to regulate these things away. And I am a banking scholar, and I've worked with banks, and so I see it very differently, right? So stepping back from and looking at the whole history of banking, this is a relatively new concept, and banks are very different now the last, I would say, 20 years than they have been for over two centuries. And they're different in not the way that they operate, not just the way that they operate, but also the way we think about the banking sector. And so going back to sort of the signing of the Constitution, there was this push and pull between, you know, Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson saying, you know, Alexander Hamilton, we need central banking that works for the government and is, you know, centralized in the federal government in Washington, D.C., and Jefferson, of course, being the agrarian populist, saying, no, we need small banking that is totally, you know, separated from the federal government. So there was this push and pull, and this lasted for, you know, the first century. The point here is that the reason why Thomas Jefferson wanted small banking not concentrated in the federal government was to protect, you know, the agrarian farmers, the powerless, the low income, I guess, in the words of today, from big money having a lot of political influence. But also the reason why Alexander Hamilton wanted centralized banking was not because, as I think is unfairly pegged on him, that he was an elitist and all this. He just felt like we were going to be an industrial nation and we needed a central machine of, he called banks the central machine of the greatest importance to the state. So the key there is that he felt that banks were an arm of the state, right? And so we had this theory for two centuries, and it got changed. You know, Louis Brandeis and FDR during the Great Depression came back to this, right? These banks have run amok. They're too much in control of these access to money and credit. Woodrow Wilson preceding them, also in creating the Federal Reserve, he says a great monopoly in this country is a money monopoly. So you have presidents, policymakers fighting against bank control and instilling a lot of policies and legislation that cut down the power of banks. And that fight, I mean, that lasts, again, from the signing of the Constitution until sometime in the 1980s. And that debate...
Marcia, let me just interrupt you for a moment, if I could, just to ask you, is it possible to have those two visions of banking systems function concurrently? In other words, can you have one that is, you know, sort of more networked, I guess, is in sort of like modern parlance, this one that where it is situated as a way of providing for sort of broader national interests, and one that is highly localized and not necessarily, that obviously can't be completely untethered from that first system, but is sort of firewalled in some respects. Is it possible to have both those concurrently?
Yeah, so this, I mean, absolutely, I think so. But we also have to give up this myth that necessarily having community banks is the way to increase access to the poor. And this is not that we shouldn't lament that we've lost our community banks, and we should, but it's the world is different now than it was back then. And so the way I describe it in the book is we have to honor Jefferson's and FDR and Brandeis and Wilson and Jackson's nightmare here of money being concentrated in the federal government and in these big money states. So we have to say, like, we have to recognize this fear. I mean, we're living in all of their collective nightmare, but we also have to harken back to Hamilton, who was right that we were not going to be an agrarian nation run by small farmers. We are an industrial nation, more so than I think even Hamilton would have imagined. We are a centralized government. The federal government is much bigger and more efficient than what they would have thought. And so Jefferson and Jackson were wrong, you know, in saying that we're going to fight national banking for the common people. They were right, though, that you have to fight money and power conglomerating in one place. And so I think, you know, looking at the last 10 years, it's very clear that national centralized banking has won this long fight. Now the question is, what do we do about that reality? Do we allow five or six private banks to sort of make all of these decisions with the federal government necessarily as a backstop? Or do we say, okay, this is the world we live in. Let's figure out how to make the banking sector serve us as a population. And this is where, you know, I end up in postal banking. And again, I come at it from a banking perspective, not a save the post office or get rid of payday lending. For me, this is about equalizing the playing field in the banking sector. Right. And I think...
Well, yeah. Let's go back to 1980 and just walk through that history so that we can sort of lead up to where we are now. And as you talk about this sort of this change that took place in I don't know, specifically 1980 or you know, around that time, but
around that time.
Take it there from 1980, because I also want to talk about sort of like, you know, how much the Fed how much the Fed plays into this notion of centralized banking. I mean, obviously a lot, but I mean, in what ways?
Sure. Yeah. Okay. So back up to the Great Depression before we can explain 1980. So from 1933, you know, FDR and the New Deal has this really strict banking codes. It's the first time the federal government really clamps down and says we need small banks, tons of activity restrictions, right? Interest rate caps, you've got, you can't form conglomerates, you can't have, often you can't go from one state to another, have branches across state lines, really strict banking. And this works quite phenomenally for 70 years in that, or for 50, 60 years, in that there are no panics, no runs, no financial crises until that time. And so a few things start to change in the 1970s. One is we've got technology. So we've got ATMs that, you know, allow people to take out money in another place than is their bank branch. So that's a push. We've got multinational banks coming onto our shores who don't have such regulations. So their banks feel like they're losing to these other banks. And then we have the money markets, right? So the money market account becomes as safe and as liquid as a deposit account. So money starts leaving banks. Oh, we also have really high inflation, which pushes against these interest rate caps. So instead of having a conversation at a policy level of saying, look, we've got our banks losing money, how do we change these things to honor the modern economy, but also honor the reason why we cap these banks, which is safety, security, access, et cetera. Instead, that sort of coincides with the perfect storm of the conservative movement, Ronald Reagan, Margaret Thatcher, and also just massive deregulation in every other field. And so banks say, we want to be part of that. We are just like any corporation. We're just like an airline. And so we want the government off of our backs. And so there's all of this talk about letting banks, that we've fixed the market for banking and the market will take care of it. And banks don't need all of this government intrusion. The problem is that banks aren't like other corporations. And we found out how that is in 2008, right? If they were like other corporations, that revision of the banking thing that we did in the 80s would have meant that all of these banks would have failed. But they can't fail. That's the truth of banking, is we cannot let our banking sector fail because so much relies on it. It's the central sort of machine that runs the economy. And so if that machine freezes or fails, there's a lot of externalities. And so I think that was the false narrative that started in the 1980s that is being revised, but very slowly. I think very few people took home the message of the financial crisis to say the way we thought about these things for two decades was wrong. Let's rethink this.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say that it seems like instead of sort of there's sort of a begrudging, like, well, we should do a little bit, you know, a little nip and tuck here. But fundamentally, we have not changed our perspective. We have not sort of returned to that sort of post-depression era, pre-deregulation era sensibility about banks. We're just like, we just got to do some minor nips and tucks here.
Yeah, and you saw that. I mean, you saw that with the Occupy Wall Street movement and the initial Tea Party movement. Both, you know, right and left saying we don't like this. We don't, you know, the right saying we don't like the government so, you know, so big and so invested in this private industry. And then the left saying this is crazy. It's, you know, crony capitalism. But those movements got watered down quickly. And unfortunately, President Obama, you know, is brand new on the job, and when you compare sort of his rhetoric after the financial crisis to any other previous president that faced a financial crisis, like Wilson and FDR and Jackson and Jefferson, those presidents were just like, you know, these banks are, you know, scum, and we're going to get them. And Obama, you know, says to AIG after they passed out bonuses, after a huge bailout, I am standing between you and the pitchforks, right? So he is saying, you know, I am going to Wall Street, stand behind me, and I'm going to protect you almost. And I know that Obama was meaning to make reforms, but there was no pitchfork holding policymakers at the time. And I think that, not that the pitchforks are smart or that they're wise, but it does have a push and pull, right? You swing the pendulum a little bit and say, why not have someone like a, you know, vocal Elizabeth Warren who came in later, but for her to say, no, this is totally not okay. And she was in the mix at the time, but, you know, Obama didn't bring her in, and there's some internal politics there, but
right.
He didn't have anyone like a Warren on his team that was really pushing for just fundamental changes.
And I mean, you know, it seems to me, I mean, at least in terms of the way that our government and sort of, I guess, then by extension, the Fed addressed the 2008 crisis. I mean, there was an opportunity. I mean, this is according to Barney Frank, of course, but there was apparently an opportunity to, rather than give a ton of money to the banks and hope that that sort of filters through to homeowners, there was an opportunity where Obama basically could have just said, yes, let's go ahead and do this, where the money could have gone directly to homeowners to relieve people on mortgages. And he just chose, you know, I mean, we don't really know why, but
well,
he chose not to do it.
That was on Bush's watch. So that
my understanding is that Paulson said, I will do this, and Bush had signed off on it. Paulson said, this was during the time that Obama was president-elect, I will do it if Obama says okay, because, you know, they don't want to do something that will constrain the next administration.
Right.
And, I mean, that's according to Barney Frank.
Paulson walked it back a little bit, and then, you know, it was the turnover happened, but it wasn't an ideological turnover. And that's sort of, you know, Paulson and Geithner weren't all that different. You know, Bernanke stays, Larry Summers comes in, but Larry Summers is, you know, pretty Wall Street minded here. And so there wasn't a sense of like, let's give these to the homeowners. And there's also, I was on Wall Street working at the time, right? So there's nobody, not at a bank, but at a law firm doing banking law, and there was nobody who on the industry, on the street, or in D.C. that thought we shouldn't save these banks. I mean, this was such a catastrophic shift in the way we had seen the world. It really felt like Armageddon. And if you read any of the accounts, you know, Ben Bernanke, Tim Geithner, Hank Paulson, Sheila Bair, that have written about this, they all talk about that moment being just like war, you know, and it felt like that certainly on the street. And so I think the Fed coming in, you know, back to your original question, and you know, really overreaching from their powers, they had really showing its muscle. I think everybody on both sides of the aisle, on the street and off the street, wanted that. And it was because of that that the economy is saved. And so I actually don't fault the Fed for doing what it had to do. I think we need to figure out why it is that we had to go to such extreme measures and get comfortable with the fact that we're there again. We still have a system where the Fed would have to do the same thing. And so, you know, I think that given the circumstances, that was the only choice that there was, because otherwise we would have had, you know, Tim Geithner says we would have been in shanty towns. I think that's overstating, but I think the question is, we're still there. Do we really want to face another crisis where the Fed has to come in and shovel trillions of dollars into the financial sector?
All right. Well, before we get to how is that preventing that related to the idea in your book that there is a fundamental inequality in that some people are some people are basically some people are banked and some people are unbanked. Explain what that means and sort of tie those two concepts together.
Absolutely. So, you know, I think when you understand how the Federal Reserve saved these banks and that all of these banks are shored up by this massive government machinery that includes the Federal Reserve, but not just the Federal Reserve. You've got the FDIC Insurance Fund. You've got, you know, all of these other regulatory codes. And then just that backstop, right, that implicit sort of, if you falter, we will come to your aid. And then explicit, you know, if you need liquidity, like if a bank is in trouble but just needs to pay out depositors, they can go to the discount window at the Federal Reserve and get that short-term loan. So we have this government apparatus that shores up the banking industry, and I think for good reason. This is why we didn't have, you know, runs and collapses like we used to before the Great Depression. So that's all good. But when that money goes into those banks and shores them up, it's a huge subsidy, and I think subsidy is an understatement. But then those banks turn around and exclude, you know, something like 40% of the population from that credit that is so, you know, generously given to them. So I think that's the fundamental inequality in our banking system. Sure, fine, we're going to support banks. That's just the reality of how banking works. But we need to make sure that all of that support is conditioned on banks serving the population equally. And if they refuse to do it, we can, one, force them to do it, which I don't think works. I've seen it in practice. I think banks resist this, and the thing that comes out ends up being a harmful product to the people that need it. So I think we can cut out the middleman, and that's where I talk about a public option in banking is, okay, if you're not going to do it, then we're going to send some of that credit, a small part of it, straight to the public through whatever mechanism we can use it. And I think the post office makes sense, but I'm not wedded to that. You know, I just think it's an
you already have the bricks and mortar there. You already have the retail outlets. You don't need to build anything.
Right. And it's abroad. That's what people have done. We have done it here. We did it for 50 years, you know, so it's not a radical reinvention of our, you know, central machinery.
And we've, like I say, we've talked about postal banking on this program, but more in terms of sort of the very basic functions of a bank. And I don't know that we have gotten into that aspect of credit, right? Because there's two different, arguably two broad categories of what you want out of a bank. One is to be able to sort of get cash, to cash your checks, to do some sort of very basic services. And then the other is credit. Explain to us, I think it's fairly obvious to people as to why it would be, give us a sense of why both is really necessary, and particularly how the credit function would work and what the benefit of that would be.
Sure. So one, why credit? I think this is going to be quite controversial because I think people don't understand exactly what how credit works. Or maybe they do understand it, but we're fearful of credit and debt, right? We live in a credit state, right? Most of us owe more than we have in assets, right? Most of us are underwater if you look at our, you know, mortgages and student loans and things like that. But that's not, it's not a moral failing. It is just the way our economy works. You know, you see the Federal Reserve, you know, tinkering with these interest rates and pumping money into banks. You look at the federal debt. You know, I think it's scary to some people that we're quote-unquote in debt, but it's not exactly the way it appears. In other words, money has become an abstract concept. There is no gold standard, and I know some people would like to bring that back, which is, I think, very unrealistic. But because we don't,
it would also be sort of a disaster too. I mean,
it would be a disaster. It was a disaster back then when we had the gold standard.
Yes,
I mean that's why we had so much uncertainty and speculation. But yeah, I think we live in an economy that where credit is it's based on sort of trust in the system. So I won't get too abstract, but I do think that
hesitate. I mean, I think, you know, we've talked a lot about modern monetary theory on this program, and also just sort of the value of our currency coming from the fact that we have debt. And so yes, feel free.
So I think most of us get these credit that makes our lives run, like our mortgage, our student loan, all of these things, from this Federal Reserve apparatus that pumps money into banks, creates that money, right? And then we get those loans from banks or from the agencies, the federal government agencies like the Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, the Sallie Mae, that administer these credit markets and do so at a subsidy. Now, the only people who are left out of this are the poor who have to pay, quote unquote, and I don't agree that it is the market price, but they are left to pure market credit, and those are the payday lenders and the modern day loan sharks, right? So they pay astronomical rates for credit, and the reason a lot of, you know, in the discourse is, oh well, they're higher risk, but that doesn't make sense if you look at the credit that banks get, right? Banks are just as high risk. In fact, they fail more so than and more disastrously than do people. So banks get this credit to tide them over from one quote-unquote payday to a next, but people don't. And so I think this is something that could be fixed very easily, and we're talking about small loans. And the way that...
And we should say, I want to just clarify that notion. I mean, the banks are not only a higher risk, particularly like, you know, we follow that sort of notion of a 1% doctrine. I mean, a bank failure is far more catastrophic to society or to a community than maybe one person going into Chapter 7 or something, or Chapter 11 or personal bankruptcy, whatever the number is. And we should also add that the risk is far greater. The failure is far more catastrophic, and it's really more of a question of leverage, isn't it? I mean, it's just sort of like,
absolutely.
The bank we can't let fail. And the only reason why it's not priced into the equation is that they just say, well, you know, you take us down, we're going to take you with us. So
absolutely. Yeah, and they operate on leverage. They need a certain amount of leverage to grow money. But, you know, Lehman Brothers, before it collapsed, had a leverage of 1 to 28. If an individual had that, I mean, they would be failing phenomenally. So we don't tolerate that for people.
And the leverage I'm talking about is the size of a threat. I mean, it's basically just that the bank has a gun to our head if they go under. And, you know, Joe Stevenson, I'm making up a name, just coming off the street, he doesn't have a gun to the community's head. He just goes down. And so the bank is basically threatening us.
Exactly. And there's this moral approbation that we give to people who borrow money. We say you're irresponsible, you're not thinking straight, you know, debt is just like the sign of, you know, weakness and, you know, you're not being wise. And with banks, that's just how they operate, right? We say, well, Lehman, you know, had all these debts, but they were, you know, making risks, they're making bets that, you know, that's just the business of doing whatever they were doing, investment banking. But I think that's where you see small credit. And here's the thing about small credit to the poor. It is the difference between solvency and insolvency. So someone has a job, right? They need $500 because their car breaks down, or you know they have an extra expense because their kid's sick, or whatever it is. You have an extra expense, $500 a month, or something like that. Now you can go and get that $500 from a normal lender and pay the interest and you know stay afloat. But when you go to a payday lender and get $500, you end up paying $2,500. And by the time all is said and done, you're bankrupt. You know, you've rolled over that loan. You have lost all of your assets. You've pawned your belongings. And you still haven't paid off that debt. And so it takes a temporary sort of hiccup in your life and turns it into a real financial disaster. And that is why, by the way, banks have these Federal Reserve discount windows, because that happens to banks too, right? You can have a shortfall of, you know, $1 million that you're good for, right? You've got that money coming in. And so you go to the Federal Reserve discount window, you get that $1 million, you pay off your creditors, and you stay afloat, right? You get to operate the next day as opposed to have to liquidate. But we don't offer the same sort of lifeboat to the poor. And so I think we should. And this, again, is a matter not of economic principles, but of moral ones. And I think this is a decision that we have made as a public and we can remake. And, you know, how we treat different people is a public policy decision, as is the price of credit, right? Credit, there's no sort of pure market for how much you pay for things. It's a government decision, and the government has decided not to run credit markets for the low income. And I think it's a decision that we publicly can make.
How would that work in practice? I mean, what would the Fed just provide essentially a discount window, let's say through the postal system, you know, to the postal system as a sort of a new entity, or how would that work?
Yeah, no, you wouldn't need federal involvement at all, actually. You would just have the post office run a bank that was that operated with the cost of credit. So you would take people's deposits. And here's one way that maybe just taking deposits and offering people a savings account would eliminate the need for a loan, right? A lot of poor people just don't have a place to save their money. So you would offer savings accounts for people, and they would come in, hopefully, and bring in, you know, small savings deposits, and then you would pool those and lend them out to others in need, just the way a bank does, but at lower costs, right? Banks are no longer taking small deposits. This is why a lot of folks are unbanked, because they keep slapping fees on you, right?
Right.
So you would go, you would have the central pool, and then you would, you know, someone needs $500, they'd come into the post office, their branch, buy it. By the way, it wouldn't have to be like, you wouldn't have to stand in line. You could just do it online the way any other bank does. So you would go in, you'd get the $500, and the rate of interest would be whatever the post office needed to cover their costs. And this could be much lower without any subsidy, much lower than the payday lending sector. One, because they don't have to pay their staff.
There's no profit. There's no profit.
Well, there's no profit, and they also don't have an overhead.
Right.
that the other startups do. They would just use that existing infrastructure. So in the event that there is a subsidy, it would just be using that overhead. It wouldn't be more money coming in to do this.
How is this different? Is it materially different from the notion of like North Dakota's state-owned bank?
Yeah, it would be a public bank, but different. North Dakota's is the state bank. It is. It does big loans. It does commercial loans. It operates on a really sort of high level of sophistication and a lot of money. This is not. This is very simple services. The way we did it in the past was in the United States, cap deposit accounts. You know, so if you have $100,000 to invest, you wouldn't do it at the post office. And then, you know, you would have basic services. You're not going to get your mortgage loan from the post office or your student loan. Whereas the Bank of Dakota is a full service bank that funds a lot of big projects in the state and other banks in the state. That's sort of their central bank there, not to be confused with the Federal Reserve Central Bank. But here, we're not talking about that. We're talking about an institution that takes the place of payday lending, check cashing, and introduces to the market a small saving, sort of financial service entity. This is not going to take over other banks, you know, not to be worried, Bankers of America, right? This is just people who you're not interested in. You have stopped serving for the last two decades, just providing them with essential services.
And so give me a sense of, I know that there was a hope with, is there a full complement of postal commissioners? Is this idea, I know that Bernie Sanders has raised this idea, has it been raised in the context of the post office, or is the postmaster general basically said that we're not going to do this?
Yeah, so good question. You know, I've been talking about this for about three or so years. About a year ago, the Post Office Inspector General came out with a white paper, and I've been working with them. So that is an office within the post office, but it's outside of the central body of the post office. And so they proposed this and ran the numbers and basically did a business plan of how this might work and you know, not profit the post office without costing too much. So that was about a year ago. And right away, Senator Warren came out in support, and the unions came out in support. So we've been working together, you know, doing that. But the Postmaster General, who was Donahue previously, stayed silent or basically opposed it. There's a new Postmaster General. She has said nothing. And so, you know, the unions have put it in their contracts. They've delivered, you know, signatures just recently. About a month ago, they delivered signatures to the Postmaster General proposing this. Again, Bernie Sanders a couple months ago came out in support, which brought the issue more to the public's attention. So it's been an issue that's been simmering for over a year. I'm hoping that it gains traction as people understand the significance of it and the scale of the problem and how simple the solution is. I mean, Senator Warren has talked about it as like a win-win-win-win, right? So the post office gets saved, the people get access to these resources, and this problem with the banking inequality gets fixed. And so I think I'm hopeful that the post office, if they hear people's interest and there's some political push back, that they will change their mind, but it has to start there. I think the idea that we're going to legislate this is premature.
In other words, and we should just say that, you know, we're talking about like sort of a terribly narrow, but a subsection of some of the larger problems or larger failures of banking in this country, and this is to address one thing that just could make life significantly, well, I guess you told the attributes, it would be significantly easier and more prosperous for people in the bottom half of the income spectrum in this country, and also sort of shore up the postal service. We still have a whole host of other banking problems.
Oh, sure.
But this one is one where you're not really stepping on anybody's toes,
right?
And seems to be a very viable solution, which is why I love the idea of it so much.
Absolutely. I mean, this is not going to break up the big banks. This is not going to touch the big banks. This is a very small solution to a big problem, but it is not a panacea. There are still lots of reforms to be made, and it doesn't address the size and scale and the safety of the big banks. This is for the low income. It balances the scales a bit, but there's a lot more reforms that need to be considered. And I sort of break my book up into two parts. You know, I talk in the first part about all of the problems, and then I feel like by the time someone said this, by the time you get to postal banking, you're like, oh, that's it. Like it should be an obvious fix, but a small one, not radical, not it shouldn't ruffle that many feathers.
Well, let's hope so. Marisa Baradaran, professor of law, Georgia Law School, author of How the Other Half Banks, Exclusion, Exploitation, and Threat to Democracy. We'll put a link to that book on our site at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, folks. Going to head into the fun half. Try and keep it under control today because we're going to be on tonight. Members, of course, will get first dibs on this debate audio tonight, but it will be live for people. If you want to watch it live, you turn down your TV and listen to us after Fox Business unjustly stops our video stream. I don't know. We're gonna try to work on special ways. But so go to majoritireportradio.com or majority.fm to see the thing, to see the debate tonight. And don't forget that our program relies on our members to exist. It is because of you that we exist. When folks decide, you know what, I've got a couple of coins jingling in my pocket, too much. It's like weighing me down. Because then, you know, every day you got to get home, you got to pull the coins out of your pocket, you got to put it in a cup, and then all of a sudden like, you need a new cup because the cup is runneth over. And then are you going to take all that change down to the supermarket and put it in that thing, and they just give you credit at the market.
Worst.
It's such a pain.
One of my ex-girlfriends, when I would get back to the apartment and I would change, she would go, here comes the change. Because it would always just come cascading out, and then it just goes into a corner. It's a total waste. And instead, that could have been funneled into supporting independent media.
I know.
Media.
When I get home, my kids are like, Daddy, play with us. And I'm like, no, I have to empty the change out of my pocket and put it over there. And if only I had a way in which to get rid of that change, and I've got the solution for you. It's become a member of the Majority Report. It's literally 35 cents a day. And you support this program. It'll exist every day. And then as a bonus, we give you an extra 50 minutes a day. Almost minimum.
It's like a beyond no-brainer.
It's a beyond no-brainer. And you spend more time with your kids, spend more time with your family, maybe if you're one of those people very ambitious, you'll be able to spend more time, plotting your career. You don't have to worry about what am I doing with all this change.
Join Scientology.
You can do whatever you want.
Move more freely.
Think of how much lighter your pants will feel. You're not like weighed down by like a ton of change. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And of course, folks, many of you shop online. Some of you shop online with Amazon. Some of you shop online with Jet.com. Well, if you're making new purchases and you hadn't thought to use either one, head over to MajorityReportKickback.com. New shoppers on Jet.com, go through our link. I think you get 15% off of your first purchases. MajorityReportKickback.com. All right, folks, going to take a quick break. 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920 is the number. Tomorrow on the program, Cliff Schechter will be here to do a roundup of the week's news and the debate. Andy Kindler will talk to us not only about all the news this week, not only the Golden Globes of last week. I didn't hear anything about that. It's almost like it happened.
No, Andy's excited. He loved Ricky Gervais on the Golden Globes.
That's
and he just is calling in to praise him.
And Andy, I think, is in Bellingham, Washington, which is like the Riviera. It's like the Riviera of the Pacific Northwest, I think. I'm not sure. I'm not even sure. But all right, we'll be right back.